Well, welcome to the Epic Podcast, a chronological journey through the Old Testament. This is where you get to navigate the whole story and begin to understand the thread and meaning of the entire biblical blueprint with Michelle Neertling. Today we will be covering the book of Esther. This story unfolds roughly 52 years since the first wave of exiles returned at the decree of Cyrus to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple. Previously, Persia conquered Babylon, and after 70 long years of captivity, King Cyrus, whom God had called by name nearly a century earlier, issued a decree that set the exiles free. He sent them home with gold, silver, and sacred vessels to rebuild the temple and the city of Jerusalem. Zerubbabel, a descendant of King David, and Joshua the high priest led the first wave of exiles that returned. God gave them two prophets, Haggai and Zechariah, to encourage them, and after years of opposition and waiting, and another decree by King Darius the Great of Persia, the temple finally stood again. But not all the Jews returned to Jerusalem. Most of God's people, comfortable, prosperous, settled, chose to remain scattered throughout the vast Persian Empire. They had built houses and raised children, started businesses. The lines that once set them apart as God's people blurred as their customs blended with the nations around them. Daniel and Zechariah were given visions of the future, our future, and the prophetic timeline for things not yet revealed on the epic blueprint. Now we pick up the story more than 30 years since the last stones of the temple were laid, in the book of Esther. Life in Jerusalem had quietened into routine worship, yet far beyond those temple courts, in the bustling heart of Persia, another chapter of God's story was about to unfold. At this point, the throne of Persia belonged to King Xerxes, the grandson of King Cyrus. He ruled from the citadel of Susa, far east of Babylon, where Daniel once served, and hundreds of miles from Jerusalem. His kingdom extended from India all the way to Ethiopia. He had it all: power, wealth, glory. But like every ruler before him, his empire would serve God's epic design. King Xerxes was married to Queen Vashti. Though Xerxes maintained a vast harem of concubines, there was only one queen, chosen for her nobility as much as her beauty, and she could not easily be replaced. To dispose a queen was to break custom and challenge the very order of the court. Yet in God's unseen strategy, even the unshakable would soon be shaken, and the impossible door opened. Xerxes was not only powerful, but extravagantly wealthy, and in the third year of his reign, he wanted the world to know it. So he threw a celebration unlike any other, a royal banquet that lasted 180 days. Folks, that's 6 months, half a year of feasting, flaunting, and showing off the full splendor of his empire. All the who's who were invited, nobles, princes, military commanders, governors, every influential man from India to Ethiopia. And when those 6 months finally ended, Xerxes wasn't done. He hosted one more feast, this time a 7-day party in his private palace garden, open to everyone in Susa from the least to the greatest. By the 7th day, scripture says, the king was high in spirits from the wine. Caught up in pride and intoxicated by his own grandeur, Xerxes sent for Queen Vashti, his most prized possession, to appear before his guests and display her beauty. But Vashti refused. It was a bold and miscalculated move on her part, and it didn't go down well. Xerxes' advisors were horrified. If the queen could defy the king, every wife in the empire might do the same. Something had to be done, so they urged him to make an example of her, and the decree went out that Vashti would never again appear before the king. What looked like a domestic scandal was, in heaven's view, the Lord's first move in a divine chess game, because the enemy was lurking on the horizon, an evil man ready to destroy God's people. God wanted to position his trump card. He allowed a crown to be removed so that in time it could be placed on another head, one that would change the course of history. Sometime later, when the laughter from those long feasts had faded, and perhaps, though he'd never admit it, The king missed the queen he dismissed. His attendants, ever eager to please, came up with a suggestion. Let a search be made for a beautiful young woman for the king. And so began a kingdom-wide search, a contest to find the next queen of Persia. From every province, young women were brought to Susa. They were taken from their homes, groomed for months, and trained in court etiquette, each one hoping, or perhaps dreading, to be chosen. Among them was a young Jewish woman named Hadassah, known by her Persian name Esther. She was an orphan raised by her cousin Mordecai, a quiet man of faith who served at the king's gate. Esther's life had been simple, even hidden. She was not chasing crowns or attention. Like so many of us, she probably prayed for purpose, for direction, for something more, never realizing that her quiet obedience was already part of a much larger plan. Esther was just a young woman trying to find her place in a world that had already taken too much from her. She had lost her parents at a young age, a wound that shapes you in only ways God can truly heal. Mordecai, her older cousin, took her in as his own daughter. He taught her the stories of their people, the faithfulness of God through Abraham, Moses, and the prophets. He raised her to trust that even in exile, the Lord had not forgotten his promises. Still, there must have been days when Esther felt unseen. She had no grand title, no inheritance, no promise of marriage. Just an ordinary girl in a foreign land, carrying quiet dreams like any woman her age, of belonging, of being loved, of living a peaceful life. And then everything changed. Without warning, soldiers arrived in her neighborhood and took her with the others to the king's palace. She would never have volunteered. She was chosen, drawn into a story she neither sought nor understood. Imagine her fear leaving behind the only family she knew, separated from Mordecai, her home, her routines, and her freedom. Instantly, her life was no longer her own. Now she would just be one among hundreds, perhaps thousands in the king's harem. Just a number, nameless. But heaven knew her name. Heaven was in control. As soon as she arrived, God's favor unraveled like a red carpet ahead of her. She immediately found kindness with Haggai, the eunuch, in charge of women. He went out of his way to provide her with the best rooms, special food, and even gave her 7 attendants. Scripture says she won favor in the eyes of all who saw her. Doesn't that sound a lot like Joseph, who, like her in the most difficult circumstances, carried favor, because God was preparing them to rescue his people? Neither Esther nor Joseph knew the details or the why, but their quiet, patient faith would render them heroes in a story still unfolding, a story that would take time and reveal its secret, not overnight, but at the exact time it was due. The women gathered for the king were extensively prepared. 12 months of grooming, 6 months with oil of myrrh, 6 with perfumes and cosmetics, every detail designed to please King Xerxes. While others competed for beauty and attention, Esther remained steady. She listened, she observed, she waited, and God began to move. She didn't know it yet, but her obedience, her humility, and her quiet faith were aligning her life with something far beyond what she could imagine. And then, after months of waiting, Esther's moment finally came. In the 7th year of Xerxes, the day arrived when she would be brought before the king. There were no guarantees, no promises, only the quiet knowledge that her life could change forever, one way or the other. She held her breath. Her beauty wasn't in her adornment, it was in her peace. Scripture says she asked for nothing except what Haggai, the king's attendant, advised. That's such a subtle line, but it tells us everything about her heart. She trusted the wisdom that God had placed around her, and ultimately the unseen hand guiding her steps. And then the king, the most powerful man on earth, saw her, and he was moved. The text says the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she found favor and kindness in his sight more than any of the other virgins. He placed the royal crown on her head, and I'm sure she sighed with relief, a bittersweet moment. Her promotion was a God-ordained shift woven in silence through the threads of pain, obedience, and perfect timing. Esther's rise wasn't luck. It wasn't coincidence. It was alignment. Every delay, every tear, every unanswered prayer, all of it was leading here. What she didn't know was that her breakthrough was part of a much larger story. God had positioned her for a rescue not yet revealed. To celebrate, Esther declared a great feast, the banquet of Esther. Gifts were lavishly given and a holiday was granted throughout the empire. Meanwhile, Mordecai, Esther's cousin, kept watch, looking out for her. Stationed at the king's gate, he remained close. One day, he discovered two men conspiring to assassinate the king. Mordecai immediately sent word through to Esther. The matter was investigated, confirmed, and recorded in the royal chronicles. Mordecai was credited, but not rewarded. A good deed, quietly done, overlooked by man, but not by God. We will see how this will resurface at the appointed time, and it will be vital to God's plan in the story. It reminds me of Galatians 6 verse 9. Let us not become weary in doing good, for at the proper time we will reap a harvest if we do not give up. Nothing we do in good faith goes unseen. God will reward us at the proper time. While this was unfolding, palace politics made its next move. Haman, the Agag, was given a seal of honor by the king and promoted above all the other nobles. Haman gained the king's confidence so thoroughly that everyone, including the royal officials, were commanded to bow before him at the palace gate. But Mordecai would not bow. His allegiance was to God alone. Haman's pride would not have it. When Haman saw that Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor, he was enraged. Yet having learned who Mordecai's people were, he scorned the idea of killing only Mordecai. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes. Folks, Haman was a descendant of the Amalekites, the first spiritual enemy Israel faced in the wilderness. Now, generations later, that same spirit rises again, wanting to destroy God's people. But Haman held sway with the king and manipulated him with half-truths and money. He claimed the Jews were lawbreakers, a threat to his kingdom's stability. And so, in the 12th year of Xerxes' reign, 5 years after Esther was crowned queen, a decree was sealed with the king's signet ring. They cast a lot, and the date for destroying the Jews was chosen. Couriers were sent across the empire with an edict. On the 13th day of the 12th month, every Jew, young and old, was to be destroyed. Folks, since Persia controlled all the territory from India to Ethiopia, that would mean all the Jews. The city of Susa was in an uproar. Across the provinces, the Jews mourned, they fasted, they cried out to God. Mordecai, broken and distressed, went to the king's gate in sackcloth. He sent word to Esther, along with a copy of the edict, pleading with her to intervene. But Esther hesitated. She didn't want to get involved. Approaching the king uninvited could cost her life, and besides, Mordecai had advised her to conceal her Jewish identity when she was first taken into the palace. Mordecai persisted. Do not think that because you dwell in the king's house, you alone will escape. If you remain silent now, deliverance will rise from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. And who knows? Perhaps you were born for such a time as this. Suddenly the fog lifted. She understood the why. Go, she said, gather all the Jews in Susa. Fast for me, no food, no drink for 3 days. I and my attendants will do the same. And when it is done, I will go to the king, though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. The next 3 days were long, silent, heavy, no breakthrough, and no peace. But on the third day, Esther rose. She dressed in royal robes and stood at the entrance of the throne room, her heart pounding and palms damp. She was launching arrow prayers towards another throne. There was no precedent for this kind of boldness, no guarantee, no safety net. Before fear could take hold of her, Exres looked up, and when he saw her, his face softened. He extended the scepter, and he invited her in. "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? Even up to half of the kingdom, it will be given to you." But Esther was wise. She knew timing was everything, that obedience must walk hand in hand with divine strategy. Instead of revealing her true request, she simply invited the king and Haman to a banquet she would prepare. Haman's heart swelled with pride. He thought he had won the queen's favor. That night, as they were drinking wine, the king again asked Esther, "What is your petition? It will be given to you. And what is your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it will be granted." But Esther sensed the Lord's strategy stirring in her spirit. She had to walk with him, not ahead of him, because God knew better than she did. So she held back. She waited. She trusted. Perhaps in that moment, the words of Proverbs echoed in her heart. "Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge him, and he will make your path straight." Esther didn't lean on instinct or emotion. She leaned into obedience. And instead of revealing her request, she invited the king and Haman to a second banquet. Haman left the first banquet elated, boasting to his friends and family. But his joy quickly turned to rage when he passed Mordecai at the gate, still standing, still refusing to bow. He was furious. To calm him down, his wife and advisors offered a solution. "Have a pole set up reaching to a height of 50 cubits and ask the king in the morning to have Mordecai impaled on it. Then go with the king to the banquet and enjoy yourself." Folks, doesn't this sound familiar? Remember when King Ahab sulked over Naboth's vineyard? Jezebel didn't hesitate. She arranged for an innocent man to be killed just to satisfy her husband's whim. That same spirit is here again. Kill the man, get rid of him, then get what you want. But that very night, King Exorus couldn't sleep, so he ordered the royal chronicles to be read to him. And as the servant read, he came to the record of Mordecai's act of loyalty years earlier when he exposed the plot against the king. The king paused. "What honor has been given to this man?" "Nothing has been done for him," the servant replied. At that exact moment, Haman entered the court, eager to ask permission to hang Mordecai. Before Haman could speak, the king asked, "What should be done for the man the king delights to honor?" Thinking the king was speaking of him, Haman declared, "Let him be dressed in royal robes, placed on the king's horse, and led through the city streets by one of the king's nobles, proclaiming, 'This is what is done for the man the king delights to honor.'" "Excellent," said the king. "Go at once. Do everything you've said for Mordecai the Jew." Oh, to have seen Haman's face, the shock, the horror. He had no idea who he was dealing with. The God of the universe always has the upper hand. The irony of heaven unfolded. Talk about having to eat humble pie. Haman had to parade Mordecai through the city, proclaim his honor, all the while his heart burned with shame. When he was done, he rushed home to lick his wounds. But before he could recover, royal messengers arrived, summoning him to Esther's second banquet. Once again, at the second banquet, the king asked Esther, "What is your request, Queen Esther?" "It will be granted." And Esther, with a trembling courage, revealed her secret. "If I have found favor in your sight, O king, spare my life and the lives of my people, for we have been sold to destruction and death." The king's face darkened. "Who is he? Where is the man who has dared to do such a thing?" Esther's voice was steady, even though her knees felt weak. "The adversary and the enemy is this vile Haman." You could hear a pin drop, and Haman paled. The king got up in a rage, left his wine, and went out into the palace garden. But Haman, realizing the king had already decided his fate, stayed behind to beg Queen Esther for his life. When the king returned, he found Haman fallen on the queen's couch. The king didn't see a man begging for his life. He saw something far more sinister. "Will he even molest the queen while she is with me in the house?" As soon as the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Then one of the eunuchs, attending the king, said, "A pole reaching to the height of 50 cubits stands by Haman's house. He had it set up for Mordecai, who spoke up to help the king." The king said, "Impale him on it." So they impaled Haman on the pole he had set up for Mordecai. Folks, do you see what just happened? God reversed the very thing the enemy wanted to use to hurt Mordecai and used it to destroy the enemy. I have seen this happen so often in my life. Awful things happen and then God flips the circumstances, and what was meant to rob me or hurt me actually turns out to be a great blessing. The week I started the Epic Podcast series, my studio was broken into. All the new recording equipment I had set up, gone. The enemy wanted to steal my voice. I was not covered with insurance yet, but by God's grace, there was a way for me to be reimbursed. And the compensation was not only enough to replace everything stolen, but it was more than enough to install an alarm system. Now I am in a better position than I was before. But even with Haman gone, the danger wasn't, because the decree he had written still stood, sealed with the king's ring. And in Persia, once a law was made, it could not be revoked, not even by the king himself. And isn't life just like that? Sometimes God flips the script. He brings justice. He brings breakthrough. But there's still residue, still consequences to confront, still a battle to finish. Just like my own story, when the studio was broken into, God provided. He reversed the loss. But I still had to rebuild, still had to resecure, still had to press forward with the mission. So Esther fell once more before the throne, weeping, pleading, not for herself, but for her people. And once again, the king extended the scepter. King Xerxes replied to Queen Esther and to Mordecai the Jew. "Because Haman attacked the Jews, I have given his estate to Esther. Now write another decree in the king's name on behalf of the Jews, as seems best to you, and seal it with the king's signet ring. For no document written in the king's name and sealed with his ring can be revoked." So they did. The new decree granted the Jews in every city the right to assemble and defend themselves, to destroy, kill, and annihilate any armed force that might attack them, and to protect their women and children, and to plunder the property of the enemies. And when that day came, the day that was meant for their destruction, the Jews rose in strength. They defended themselves valiantly, and what was meant to be a day of mourning became a day of victory, a feast of joy and remembrance. They called it Purim, named after the Pur, the lot that Haman had cast to determine their doom. A reminder that even the dice in a pagan court fall according to God's hand. Mordecai was promoted second in command to the king of Persia, clothed in royal garments and adorned with authority, honored before the empire. Folks, let us let this sink in. Esther's courage didn't just rescue her people. It restructured the power dynamics of the most dominant empire on earth. Her husband, the king of Persia, handed her the signet ring, the power to legislate. He gave her permission to write a decree in her own words, as she saw fit. And then he gave her a legacy, the estate of her enemy, now hers by royal command. The very land that once plotted her destruction became the soil of her inheritance. And Mordecai, he rose to become the second most powerful man in the Persian Empire, an empire that stretched from India to Ethiopia. This wasn't a ceremonial title. This was executive power. He had the king's ear, the king's trust, and the king's seal. It was a Joseph moment, only this time in Persia, a divine reversal so complete it echoed through history. This wasn't luck. It wasn't politics. It was providence. Esther's story is not just about bravery. It's about divine partnership. It's the perfect example of co-laboring with God. Mordecai paid attention. He positioned himself to hear and see spiritually. He did good without expecting reward. He cared deeply for his people and he recognized the fingerprints of God in the unfolding of events. Esther surrendered her circumstances. She gave her best in the harem. She remained humble. she kept her character intact. And when the moment came, she was willing to lay down everything, her comfort, her security, even her life, to save God's people. God orchestrated the setup. He opened the doors. He granted favor, and his timing was perfect, exposing the enemy, aligning the pieces, and bringing it all together. This is what it looks like when obedience meets God's timing in perfect convergence. This is how heaven moves, through ordinary people who dare to say yes. Well, folks, we'll have to wait until the next episode to see how it all unfolds. In the meantime, please share these episodes with your friends and family. Let's work together to spread the word of God and reignite a passion for the powerful, often overlooked stories of the Old Testament. Don't forget to like and subscribe to the Epic Podcast on YouTube, a chronological and visual journey through the Old Testament. You can find me under Michelle Neathling 6170, the Epic Podcast. You can also follow me on social media, Facebook, Michelle Neathling Art, Instagram, Michelle Neathling Art. And remember, that's Michelle with just one L. Check out my website, intuitiveprophetic art.co.za. If you'd like a beautiful hardcover edition of my book, The Epic, a chronological and visual guide through the Old Testament, you can order directly from me at michellenethlingart@gmail.com. Both books, Crossing the Jordan River and The Epic, are available on Takealot South Africa and soon to be on Amazon internationally.